You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiecker. Two important things to know about the five-year drought that California just went through. First, it's not really over. All across the state, the groundwater aquifers that growers tap into, especially in times of scarcity, they are dangerously low, and even the most aggressive proposals for replenishing them would take decades. Second, it is not the last drought we will go through, and it is probably not the worst drought we will go through. The geological record shows that this region, the greater Southwest, has been through mega droughts that lasted dozens or even hundreds of years. And our best climate models suggest we are pushing ourselves back towards precisely the type of climate regime that produced them. But before you start worrying about your washing machine or your shower head or what's planted in your yard or whether it's okay to flush your toilet, our next guest would like you to think about a different part of the home, your kitchen. Florencia Ramirez has just come out with a new book called Eat Less Water. The solution to worldwide water shortages is in our kitchen. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us the story of how you started thinking about and researching and writing water?
What's interesting, I really loved how you introduced this topic because I, like most people, began in the shower thinking about it. Two droughts ago in 2007, there was a one-page article in the LA Times that gave different strategies to save water. And it's the same ones that are rolled out during every drought, like take shorter showers, you know, turn off the tap. So I get into the shower and I start to consider how long are my showers, because I hadn't really given it a whole lot of thought, even though at that point I was composting and recycling and, you know, considered myself to be an environmentalist on all other fronts except for water. So I'm in the shower and I have this aha moment, like shower timers. I need to sell shower timers. And it was so random and it wouldn't go away. I started to look, do some research and found out that I wasn't the person who invented shower timers, that they had existed. And I began to import them from a supplier in Australia, because Australia has been dealing with water scarcity issues for a long time. So I then started to import these shower timers, sell them at Earth Day events and at water agencies. In fact, I sold some to the Metropolitan Water District, ended up selling 80,000 of them.
Wow.
And when I would talk to people about it, I'd say, like to you, I'd say, hey, you know, if you were to reduce your shower time by 4 minutes on average in a year, you would save 2,500 gallons of water in 1 year. Well, then I came across this research around virtual water or water footprint. And that essentially is a calculation of how much water it takes to produce any good or service. Well, it turns out that 70% of all fresh water flows to grow food. And I started to come across these water footprint numbers. For example, a glass of wine, one of my favorites, 32 gallons of water for that one glass. A slice of bread, 11 gallons of water. A dozen eggs, 268 gallons of water. A pound of beef, 1,800 gallons of water. A pound of butter, 3,600 gallons of water. So I start to delve into that deeper and find out that while I'm talking about saving water in the shower and saving 2,500 gallons in a year, we could save that much water in a week, if not less, in our kitchens, since you and I, on average, eat anywhere between 500 to 1,300 gallons of water every day with our food.
So why do you think that the state's consciousness-raising efforts around water conservation don't talk about the food system?
I think that there's a lot of politics around agriculture. What are the best policies to implement when it comes to water usage at the farm level? I don't have the right fix for that. What I write about in my book is really looking at the best way to farm and save water is smaller scale farms, organic farms that are really doing things the way they were done for hundreds, maybe thousands of years before we started to look at chemical farming. Things like biodynamic farming, things like dry farming. I remember the first dry farm I went to, it was in Paso Robles, California, a wheat farmer by the name of John DeRosier, and he farms 200 acres of wheat using no irrigation.
No irrigation.
No
at all.
Irrigation.
And this is a part of the state that's dry for at least 6 months a
yes,
year.
Yes. It has the same amount of rainfall as the city of Phoenix. So I kept asking, like, how is that possible? I mean, living where I live, I mean, I just always thought that you have to have sprinkler systems. How do you grow food without that? So he takes me down to what he calls his dirt laboratory. And he bends down and scoops up a handful of soil. And he tells me about the microbiology, the microorganisms that live in that in his soil. So he tells me that one tablespoon of soil alive with organic matter has about a billion microorganisms. And it's that holds water like a sponge. So his farm has a capacity to hold water up to 1,000 times more than a farm that's using chemicals on it for either pesticides or petroleum-based fertilizers, because chemicals are designed to kill pests or as herbicides to kill weeds. Well, the unintended consequence is that it's also killing the microbiology in the soil. And so when you do that, you're essentially creating almost like pavement, right? So that's why we have so much more runoff with these types of farms, because we've diminished the capacity of the soil to retain water. And we're not refilling our aquifers. And then it's not replenishing rivers. So then we've taken this path that is leading us to water scarcity, where you have farmers like John DeRosier and others that I write about who are looking at how do you build the soil so that when there is any moisture, whether it's rain or fog, that soil has a capacity to grip onto that water and to draw it down and hold it like a big sponge, and also replenish the underground aquifers that then is replenishing their nearby rivers.
So the way you describe John DeRosier's farm, it sounds like this win-win-win-win-win. He doesn't need to irrigate. The rivers that are near his land aren't silted up with runoff coming out of it, and certainly not chemical wastes. And you know, the food coming off of it is delicious and commands a high price at the market, which always begs the question, like, why isn't everybody farming that way?
Right. It takes more work. John DeRosier is farming pretty much on his own, those acres. Whenever he knows that it's going to rain, he gets up, even if it's like 3 a.m, and starts to turn his soil so that he can hold that his soil is ready to hold it. And I think it's also, well, the other thing is that you said it commands a higher price, and it also commands the consumer to recognize that it's valuable and to find him. It's a partnership. If we're going to change the way that food is grown on this planet, it has to be a partnership between farmers like John DeRosier, who are struggling to survive because all the rules are written to support big agriculture, and us, the eater, who's willing to make the effort to find him. Because you're not going to find his wheat at the local grocery store. You're going to find him at farmers markets. We have to support these farmers so that they exist and that they thrive and grow. Because currently, even though it feels like, especially you know, in Berkeley, it feels like there's so much organic agriculture out there. But really, it's only 3% of all agriculture in the United States is organic.
So the big criticism leveled at evangelists of organic agriculture, usually from industry finance sources, is that it's less productive per acre. John DeRosier's wheat operation grows half the amount of crop per acre that a conventional grower might with the same amount of land. And if everybody converted to growing food that way, there would be a lot of starving people on the planet.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the argument that corporations like Monsanto use as well. I have read the studies, though, that talk about how small-scale farming can support a growing population, but only if we have rules that can support farmers or help bridge farmers back into the onto the land in the way that we did when this country was growing and giving farmland away in the West. We could support a thriving small-scale farming community and help farmers to make that move. Like for in that particular case, it's making the move from farm worker to farm owner, and providing nutritious food that's not polluting our river or drawing too much water from our aquifer system to feed a community.
We're speaking to Florencia Ramirez. Her new book is Eat Less Water: The Solution to Worldwide Water Shortages is in Our Kitchens. One of the interesting things you do in the book is you make the case that not all water is equal when it comes to the water consumption of a crop. You divide it into colors: green, blue, and gray. Could you break those down for us?
That was really interesting for me to learn about when I started studying water footprint, that water researchers have given color designation to the types of water. So that really helps me to understand what to look for when I'm supporting what I call water sustainable farming practices or foods. So for example, a strawberry that's grown on a field that's irrigated using water from either underground, the groundwater, or from a reservoir or from a river, that's called blue water. That's generally what we're using here in California and really around the world. We're using blue water. And that's what's not sustainable, because we're drawing water faster than it can be replenished. The other color is green water. And green water is really where it's at when we talk about saving water with our food choices. Green water is what farmers like John DeRosier is using. He's using rain, he's using moisture, and that is the type of farming that we can support to save water. Is how do we grow our green water usage here in the United States? What's really interesting is that worldwide, most farming is using green water, rain-fed. It's, you know, like pastures, for example, up in the northern parts of our country, they don't have irrigation. It's all rain-fed agriculture. The problem with that is it's more of a pray for rain strategy. So if they're counting on good rain every year, but we're moving into a climate that is getting warmer, and so areas that have always used the pray for rain are now having to reconsider
or pray harder.
Yeah, or pray harder and bring those irrigation pipes in. So if 90% of our agriculture is using rain currently, what happens when that percentage begins to grow because they must, because they haven't built their soil and it's always been around needing that rainfall that they've had every year. Because that 10% that's left, the 10% that's using blue water, that is where all the water is flowing. So that 10% is using 70% of all reservoir water and our groundwater. So just that 10% uses 70% of all irrigation.
From the consumer's point of view, this is really hard to disentangle, because what you're telling me is basically two different almonds on the supermarket shelf could have two radically different water footprints. One might be coming from the west side of the San Joaquin Valley, mm-hmm. where it's coming from an overtapped aquifer or water that's imported from the State Water Project. Another might be from a tree planting in one of the moister corners of the Sacramento Valley, where it's living entirely off of the high water table that its mm-hmm. roots are able to get down to. There's no way for me to distinguish between those two things on the supermarket shelf.
I love that you see that, because Every single bit of food that we put in our mouth tells a water story. It's either a good one or a bad one. The only way that you and I can find those that out, like which almonds, for example, the almonds that I buy from are from the farmer's market, from a farm that is from the Central Valley, but they're dry farmed. They're not certified organic, but once you start to ask them, like, are you using petroleum-based fertilizers? No. Are you using any chemicals? No. We're just not certified. So my almonds are dry farmed. So now that I know my almond source, I don't need to find out anymore. Like, that's my go-to place to buy almonds. So you only have to figure it out once. Mm. And then, you know, maybe then the next thing that you figure out is, all right, where do I get my eggs from? I talk about this designation of better and best. Better being organic, or, you know, food grown without chemicals, because I know that once chemicals are used on land, that they've diminished the capacity of that land to hold water. So organic is better. But then I pass these organic farms on the way to take my kids to school, and I can see that the sprinkler systems are on, and it's, you know, that. And they don't necessarily need to be on at that, you know, when it's raining, or that particular farm that I'm speaking of is also owned by the same people who own the conventional farm across the street. So I knew that yes, organic is important and it matters, but is it always the best for water system? Like, what is the best? You know, organic kind of being that umbrella, but then you start to go deeper, you know, dig deeper about what is the best thing, like dry farming or biodynamic farming or holistic managed farming. So that was another term I learned. The best way to grow an animal, whether it's a chicken or it's a cow, is to rotate the animals. So what that means is that you keep them on a pasture that's fenced off, a paddock, for, depending on the time of year and how much rainfall you get, you know, it could be a week, it could be 2 weeks, and then they move them off that pasture and then move them into another pasture, and they rotate them around and don't bring them back to that original pasture until it's completely regrown. And in this way, there's this symbiotic relationship between the animal and the land. And the animal doesn't have an opportunity to overgraze. And there's no necessity to cut down forests, because open pasture, you know, pasture-raised animals is not in and itself the answer if they are, you know, able to just graze without any checks and balances. Then what happens is that they overgraze, and then the farmer then, you know, carves out more of forests and then moves the animals into that area and then carves more forest. So that's not the answer. So what I found is it's, you know, asking that question, do you rotate your animals? And I find that sometimes I ask that question and they have no idea what I'm saying. Or I'll find that farmer who says, yeah, I do rotate, and is really excited that somebody knows about it and cares about it and values it with my dollars. And so once I found my egg person, then that's it, I'm done. Or even at the grocery store, looking at the labels, and you will find some of the labels will mention that they rotate their eggs or rotate their chickens. But the point is you just have to do it one time. You just have to do the research once, and then you're done.
My impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the more things a grower can brag about sustainability-wise on their label, the more they charge. Mm-hmm. And for some people, that's a real obstacle to shopping sustainably.
Right. We all come at this with a different price point, with a different budget. But we can all do more than what we're doing now. So maybe it means that instead of buying the organic milk and your organic dairy, because really where we make the biggest impact is on animal products, because mm-hmm. they are the biggest user and polluter of water systems. Or your berries, those organic berries are certainly a lot more than the conventional. Or, you know, it's maybe not doing it every time, but maybe every other time you do it, you buy the organic one. And not everything costs money. So, for example, we throw away 50% of all of our food here in the United States. You and I certainly throw away food in our you know, that's been left over in our refrigerators. That saves money if we can figure out in our own kitchens what can we do to reduce our own food waste. So for me, it means planning my meals. I have a chalkboard wall where I write up our menu for the week. So that saves money. The other thing I find for myself is, you know, when I'm buying meats from the farmer's market, for example, I'm spending a lot more money. So naturally, I'm eating a lot less of it. So my sausages that I buy, for example, it costs me $12 a pound. That's a lot. That's a lot more than if I were to buy conventional, a factory farmed sausage. But you better believe that I am not going to waste a single slice of that sausage. I'm going to make sure that we are eating it and enjoying it. And then I know that I'm not going to have it every week either. It's, you know, it's something that we do, you know, maybe every other week or every third week. So then naturally there's a reduction of what you're the meat that you're eating in the diet, because that's certainly the one that costs the most.
Before we wrap up the interview, I have to go through one of the most devastating things I learned, which is the water footprint of chocolate.
Yeah.
So it's not good.
Well, okay, so this now that you know about the water designations, so chocolate, one chocolate bar is 449 gallons of water, but it's green water. Mm-hmm. There's no way that you could grow chocolate here in California without using tremendous amounts of water, which is why we don't do it. It has to be grown in the tropics. What the story of chocolate is attached to gray water, which is the pollution. And when you buy a chocolate bar that is not only organic, but a direct trade chocolate bar where the chocolatier is purchasing directly from small scale farms in the tropics, whether it's in Africa or in Latin America, you know that you're supporting agriculture that is not just it's just green water, but that they're not polluting the river that they swim in and draw water from in their community.
What are the impacts of conventional chocolate grows on the water bodies nearby?
Pollution. And because the climate is changing as well in the tropics, they're using more chemicals as a result. And that's running off into not only the wells, but into the rivers.
Well, Florencia Ramirez, it's good to know there's at least an alternative. Thank you so much for coming in. Thank you for talking about your book with us.
Thank you so much. And just remember, there is power in the collective.
Florencia Ramirez's new book is Eat Less Water, The Solution to Worldwide Water Shortages is in Our Kitchens.